All right, I think we've all had an opportunity to get some food and get back to the table. So for the sake of time, I know there's some concerns, there's some storms coming, I guess, in the western part of the country. So let's try to keep on task, and we'll move to group two. I think, Eric, you had a couple of brief announcements, just administrative-wise.
Yeah, just as far as getting to the airport, I know folks have flights at different times. We checked with Sheila and our staff here. There is a shuttle that goes to the airport every 15 minutes or so, and then as well there are taxis apparently lined up in front. So no need to reserve ahead. You can just walk out there. There's a bellhop who will flag one down and should be within minutes. So.
Ah, super. So let's see. Group two, they dealt with medical care, which include the out-of-hospital care, the emergency department care, and inpatient care. And let's see. I've got Dr. Carr, Dr. Cooper. Who else is on here? Dr. Zane, or everybody, a lot of doctors on this one. Who's the spokesperson for group two?
I'm going to take the first swing, and
all right.
I'm sure the team will pitch in.
Sounds good.
So going in order with the question specific to domain four, now four, is when does the emergency episode of care begin? This one is the only one we had consensus on, and we agreed that it should begin when symptom onset begins, not at first contact with medical care. And you tell me, Andrew, do you want to, there's plenty of dialogue to be had on the others. This one, do you want to stop, pause for each one for people to have feedback?
I think each group was asked that question, so we can probably just move on.
Very good. So what determines whether a patient receives medical care that met accepted standards? So now things became muddy for us promptly. We started with the structure that I think is pretty common in this speak, which is to look at outcomes, processes, and structures. And we decided that for outcomes, you know, hard outcomes are obviously the best, and the ability to meet accepted benchmarks for disease-specific risk-adjusted morbidity mortality rates is important. We think that that needs to happen at the population level, and what that means in terms of region or catchment is obviously something that needs to probably be better articulated. But that we recognize, and a primary problem here is that these outcome metrics don't exist, which is why we very often rely upon structure process proxies. So we think that, you know, a key component here is to think about the data systems that exist and to think about how we grow those data systems and what those endpoints would be if we grew those data systems. So the second tier here is the processes, and you know most as I think you know this crowd certainly knows the processes are all measured so that you can proxy an outcome that you can't measure or can't measure very well. So with the idea that processes are the aim of the process is to achieve an outcome, we thought that the gold standard here, this is a silver standard because it's not the outcome, but the standard for a process is whether or not the patient received evidence-based interventions. As a second tier, when no evidence-based interventions exist, we thought it was consensus-based interventions. And then key within this process is that systems-level metrics be met that are not condition-specific. We'll sort of circle back around on those again, but this is where we start to think about not measuring hospitals, not measuring providers, but measuring systems. And then with respect to the last one, this is the structure piece, which is, you know, so structures exist obviously to drive processes all in the hopes of driving outcomes. This is, I think, where we're stuck, because the processes that we describe above are very dependent upon the structure. And so we think that just as in the first part, we thought that there needs to be a strong push towards improving data collection systems for outcomes, here we think that there needs to be a strong push for driving some sort of systems collection inventory for resources and capabilities. We couldn't get ourselves outside of the pickle that you can't decide what process is the appropriate process for your system to meet until you have any clue what that system can or can't do. So in the absence of understanding whether or not a system has providers, resources, fixed structures, you can't decide what the right metric to hold them to is. And an obvious and I think straightforward example is, you know, you could choose, we've been using a STEMI lot here, and holding a hospital accountable to a time to cath lab metric in a hospital that doesn't have a cath lab just doesn't make sense. That's a nice clear cut one. There are lots that are much less clear cut, but without describing on the front end what your hospital can and can't do, it's hard to know then what standard they should be held to. And I guess I think that I have a couple other things to say under this one, but I think maybe want to pause because I'm sure my team who had plenty of opinions might want to chime in.
I think we all agree pretty much that the emergency episode begins when the patient or recognizes something's wrong, and the education of the public and the primary and secondary prevention measures deployed in the general population affect how quickly people access care, you know, gain access to care, understand the gravity of their illnesses, and that is really actually part of a system of care. The participants in the system of care are responsible to help educate and prevent the public. The problem with that is that it's got an uncertain time stamp. But in the hierarchy that you put about things being optimal but perhaps unmeasurable, we thought it was important to advance that as an issue. The next one, what determines whether a patient received medical care that met an acceptable standard? Again, we backed into that generically. Obviously, outcomes, the crude ones are lived or died, functional status at the end of hospitalization, things that have published metrics, easy to define. Then you back down to processes of care. You know, did they get their antibiotic timely? Did they get their medication timely? Were they seen timely? All of those kinds of things are the next level of surrogates. And then finally, the structural ones. Did the healthcare provider or did the location where healthcare was provided, was it adequately staffed? Did it have the equipment and things to do what they were supposed to do? So obviously, if you take somebody who's in labor to a sports medicine clinic, you're not going to get a very good outcome. Right. The next one is how is emergency care integrated across settings? We actually had a lot of discussion trying to define what that means. But if you go to the public health documents from HRSA and so forth, the integration of emergency care across the system includes essential services such as mental health, social service, child protective, public safety, prevention, community partnerships, community health, and those sorts of things. Now, I'm not sure that's what you were driving at. I would just pause for a moment and see. So in order to integrate all of the kinds of things, or even just to integrate with other medical services, let's say you integrate with out-of-hospital medical providers or integrate with post-discharge medical care and rehab or LTAC, or integrate with the data plane that you're collecting, you actually need a system plan with governance and authority, critical elements of the infrastructure piece that you heard earlier.
Our group took a similar approach. I was not the author of the question, so I don't know who was. But
I would push back on that. I mean, I think we had a rich conversation in our group about whether or not this governance authority, which I was referring to as a top-down piece, to build the system is important, or if you change the incentive, which again, you know, is vaguely top-down, and then allow people to innovate to get to that incentive, which is richer. The concrete examples that we talked about was the trauma system is a relatively top-down approach, where you are credentialed by whatever your credentialing agency is as being a level one or a level two or not. And Mission Lifeline sort of went the other way and allowed facilities to declare themselves to be a STEMI receiving hospital or not, and then offered to help to identify existing networks based on who was referring to who was doing cath, who wasn't doing cath, and then it allowed the community to sort of build that up themselves. At the end of the day now, if the metric becomes time to transfer if you're a non-cath lab hospital or time to cath lab if you're a cath lab hospital, the system still needs to all work together, and I have more to say about that, but I see Dr. Mayer's hand.
So, to finish up, though, if you have a system with a lot of elements in it, and you've got an element of out-of-hospital medical personnel and in-hospital medical personnel, and you've got disease-specific programs, and you've got an information frame running, there has to be a way for them to relate to one another in an organized fashion, for them to integrate all the things that they do. And in general, that's going to require oversight by someone in authority, leadership by the personnel in the system, finances as an underpinning, and an information framework in the background. And that's directly from HRSA's public health document. So the other things I would just say that are required elements for a system of care really to do this are legislative authority, lead agency, and sufficient financial underpinnings to carry forward and to be transparent in the public realm with regard to the care provided. So that's how I would just say that. And then the last thing I'm just going to talk about is what system-level measures are important in assessing the quality of emergency medical care. You can only measure things that you can answer yes or no to, you can count, or that have units of measurement associated with them, such as time, weight, volume. So in terms of doing that, we got down deep in the weeds about some of the disease-specific things, but you can back up from that and just talk about general response times, scene times, transport times, time to be seen in ED, all the standard measures that are already in place for many of the things. But I don't think there are any new and imaginative measures that haven't already been tried out. That's all I have to say.
Well, I guess, I think to reinforce what you've heard in a way, and that is whether you use the top-down or the bottom-up approach, and I think both have to be used. If you're looking at structure, process, or outcomes, it seems what works is having data and making it transparent. And we use the examples of the New York CABG outcome studies. The reason why it improved dramatically was they collected the data and they shared it with the public. And all of a sudden, cardiac surgery became much safer in New York State. And it's pure data and transparency. And I think you can use that to utilize, again, the infrastructure, the processes that you happen to pick or the outcomes, but you have to collect the data and you have to share it and it has to be transparent and used. And I think the second part is if you take it that way, it makes it somewhat simplistic because with data, you can make the system move the direction you want because everybody sees it and everybody wants to do well. The second is just to reinforce. I think you have to have a oversight structure which is global, and we've never had that. And so if you want various silos to work together, you need to put them underneath the same oversight structure and not under different ones, because then we all play those games at every level in our lives and business and everything plays that system against itself and you get nowhere. And so I think if we're really going to move this system forward, the system needs to be under one leader or one leadership model and not left in a bunch of different silos under different leadership so that it can be continued without moving it forward as a common system. So I would just push those two concepts as major goals that we need to do to move the overall system forward.
To add on to that, the question on some level under running through all of this is how much of this NQF can do, how much is our mission versus how much is a legislative mission. So as I was trying to think concretely about this, I offered something that I'd offered to the group. I offered it internally, and we had a dialogue about it. And that is, how much should there be shared risk, shared reimbursement, shared accountability for unplanned critical illness? And this, the very specific example that we were using was, I think we talked about cardiac arrest, and we talked about whether or not EMS's reimbursement should be tied to the ultimate gold standard, patient outcomes, even though they are very, very proximal, And even though they may do perfectly on their process measures, because there is no gold standard for them, they're not the end of the chain of survival. The end likely happens as an inpatient or upon hospital discharge. If we think the gold standard is the patient's outcome, should we be advising CMS, should we be advising the metrics makers to be thoughtful about how they can make both the hospital or the multiple hospitals in the region and the EMS system all have skin in the game? So they are all dependent. Their dollar reimbursement is all dependent upon the overall outcome, no matter what their part in that game is. And, you know, there was conversation about this, and not everybody felt like that was a fair thing to do, and I look forward to the group's conversation.
It isn't that all of us didn't think that was a that there needed to be shared accountability, but that the system of penalties and rewards needed to be aligned, you know, appropriately with the degree of contribution to a particular outcome. By definition, every component of the system can really only be measured in and of itself by its intermediate outcome, you know, what it can do in that particular, you know, phase of care, whereas the system as a whole, you know, can be measured, you know, from start to finish. Very hard to hold any individual component, you know, to that standard. You know, we're in America, we're in some ways the victim of our history and our politics, and you know, we were so afraid when the Republic was founded of tyranny that we divided, you know, separated and divided power so completely that at times it's you know, everyone's you know, at odds with one another. You know, but to look at the disaster realm for a minute, you know, when one of the things I like to say is, you know, who's in charge? Well, everybody's in charge of what they're in charge of. And I think that's the kind of model that we need to adopt here to follow on both Ron's and John's and Brendan's points. You know, in circumstances where this has been achieved, where some measure of joint accountability has been achieved, it's always been in the context of a public-private partnership. You know, that as we in New York like to refer to them, the heads of the five families, you know, kind of get together around a table with an appropriate official from public health or government and they work together to come up with a common public health oriented solution that works to improve the system as a whole. That's not unlike a unified command kind of concept in terms of disaster management. But in effect, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? I mean, when I'm speaking to disaster oriented people, I sometimes refer to our emergency care system as an individual casualty incident as opposed to a mass casualty incident. And, but the systems of care, you know, that are required are not unlike one another in that the patient is like a baton in a relay race and it requires every runner, you know, to sort of do his or her thing to make sure that the baton doesn't get dropped. But there's got to be a coach and there's got to be somebody overlooking the whole thing. And again, it usually works best in the context of a public-private partnership. Why? Because the public has the authority and the private has the expertise. And if we can bring those together, and find a metric, you know, that in effect guarantees, you know, that warm and fuzzy togetherness, we'll be, a long way down the road, a long way further down the road than we are right now.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with Brendan and echo that I think that implementing this shared accountability model is critical for really making these regionalized systems work. And the genius of this group, again, is that we're kind of thinking that through. And we don't necessarily have all the answers right now, but I think this has really got to happen. And it may be that EMS, for example, in cardiac arrest, is held financially accountable for what happens in the hospital to some extent because they control what hospital patient goes to. And if the hospital isn't participating and engaged in a appropriate way, then maybe they shouldn't be taking patients there.
Yeah, I guess building on what Dr. Carr said, I'll go back to my point about a system capability index, because depending on the environment, EMS could do everything just fine, and the hospital could do everything just fine, and because the patient was so unfortunate as to experience their cardiac arrest 150 miles from the hospital, the outcome could be suboptimal. So if we're going to reward either system components or systems as a whole financially based on outcome measures, then we have to put those within the realm of the possible, which is to some degree varies every place.
I think that's a really important point, and I apologize if we weren't more explicit about it. So just to, you know, the CABG reporting stuff is an important thing too, because no one would ever report injury outcomes or any outcomes in health services research literature without appropriately case mixing and adjusting. And part of the case mix adjustment in unplanned critical illness, I think, is geography or is access to the right resources. It just sort of echoes back to the fact, as part of number two, I was saying you almost need a separate set of processes for each set of structures. And one of these structures is whether there's a cath lab at the hospital, whether you're 200 miles away from the hospital, all of these pieces. And this is the piece where I think where we're the most stuck is if we don't know, it's hard without having the lay of the land to know what processes people should be held to. And I don't know how we get around that. I mean, maybe it's data, but here you don't mean outcome data. Here you mean some basic logistics about, or some descriptives about what the hospitals can provide 24/7, 365.
What I'm hearing is a discussion of why no one of these elements on its own is enough, but why there needs to be multiple elements joined together to really oversee the medical care portion of this. So it starts with the authority to create a system plan and to monitor what happens within the system, and it's laced with financial incentive and disincentive, and perhaps even legal or regulatory incentive and disincentive, and gap analysis that leads to improvement through data framework. So we've heard all those things, but I think that's how the puzzle pieces come together.
It occurs to me, and I'm surprised it hasn't come up in my mind before this, but as Brendan was talking, it occurs to me that we haven't really talked about taking the population's needs and marrying them to what the system provides. So in other words, we need to look at the populations that we serve, which may be different in one area of the United States versus another or in another country. And you look at their disease burden and you look at their risk. And some of those risks may be age or comorbidities or the geographic location where they're at or the activities that they do. You take the population needs, and you could, in fact, predict what resource what injuries or diseases they might get. And then you could then say, well, based on that, we then have this is the kind of healthcare system that needs to surround this particular population. And you would... It's almost like the old-fashioned certificate of need thing when we were first looking at building hospitals in this country. You know, you had to submit a CON, and it had this name. Who's this particular population that you're serving, and why do you think you need, you know, three hospitals or two hospitals, whatever? And so it occurs to me that, and maybe this discussion has already gone on in other forums that you all have engaged in, but it just occurs to me we haven't really mentioned that. And thinking about what's the population that's being serviced and their disease burden and their risks, and then you develop a system that will address what those needs are. So you would have population measures that would help you understand, you know, what the needs are, and then you would have system measures based on what those needs are that you need to meet, and then you would have disease measures. And I don't know that we've necessarily thought about systems development in that way. But as Brandon was talking, that was kind of what was occurring to me. And since they're the ones that are talking about data collection, and we don't have data to say how many cath lab or what the performance needs to be, it just tumbled to me that we haven't necessarily included. We can build a lot of things and we can measure a lot of things, but are we really meeting the needs of the community or the population we say we're serving? I don't know that we have that information as part of informing the system.
But that's why we put such emphasis on the data component. I mean, just based on that, you know, whether it's the structure, the processes, the outcome, whatever level of the process you want to look at, we need more data, and we need good data so that we can validate both need, you know, how many cath labs do you need, where. I mean, that's how you build the system with any logic. And then you monitor the system with, again, data on the outcomes and make sure that your plan fits the needs of the disease and the population. And as John just said, then you look at the gaps based on the data, and you fill the gaps in. But again, the one thing that it really requires for it to work is somebody has to be in charge. And I think I sort of personally agree with the public-private mix. I think that those are the kind of systems that have worked well in the past, and I think that's what we're evolving to. But we have no consistent oversight. Whether CMS wants to take it or whomever, I mean, I'm not going to say which entity should do it, but somebody needs to, or we'll never get these disparate processes on the same page as far as the system goes.
You know, part of the reason that kind of planning process, you know, has come unstuck, you know, is because the healthcare costs continue to rise despite that kind of planning process. And in and around the late 80s, mid to late 80s, early 90s, people said, well, this planning process has failed. We really need to go to a market solution, whereby we, you know, individually negotiate rates with hospitals, providers, et cetera, to drive the cost down, that way. That having been said, I think there's a perfect example of the fact that what you're saying, Kathy, you know, should work and can work, does work, and that's, you know, for all of its faults, the VA system. You know, they function, they function in terms of their resource allocation just in exactly that way. It's a mutual planning process that involves the entire system, but the system has governance. And every hospital has to make its case for the number of providers and the amount of resource that it needs based upon, you know, the population that it served. And, you know, with the advent of quality measures within the VA, from which the NISQIP system that the College of Surgeons uses, as you all know, was born, you know, that I think in many ways is the proof of the pudding. And to me, while America being America, you know, we're never going to be in a situation, maybe not never, but certainly for the foreseeable future, not in a situation where we're gonna see individual hospitals collaborating, sharing data, you know, to improve best outcomes and so on. You know, I think a strong argument can be made that emergency care is a public good, and that, you know, and that the public has an absolute right to do that for emergency care because there's no caveat emptor involved. You know, the public can't choose. You know, the public's got to go where the system takes them, or you know, a nearest trauma center, nearest semi center, nearest stroke center, what have you, when they're in the kind of mental state where they can't make, you know, an informed decision. So the public has to make that decision for them. You know, and under those circumstances where the public has to decide on behalf of the individual citizen because he or she cannot do so on his or her own, I think a very strong argument can be made that the public good model applies and that therefore it's absolutely necessary to have some kind of robust system, system of governance in place that links, you know, the healthcare system with the public health system, you know, with appropriate authority to do planning and rational distribution of resources.
I definitely agree, and I like Kathy. I like your suggestion. I like your observation. I think there's definitely a need for more public health-like integration into these systems, and based on local community need or regional need, it makes all the sense in the world, and it's something that we honestly have lacked.
And I think it's interesting, if you look at bullet point 4, which I think was trying to capture what I was saying, I think it's worded the opposite. Because what we're saying is we're taking what the system provides, we're trying to make sure it fits the, if you needed to find the needs of the population, and then you build a system that addresses them, not the other way around.
I like what I'm hearing, of course, but I think it's a different meeting. You know, ours is about the measures, and this is like how and what people should do. And I will tell you, I think it'll change over time how you use the data, and also depends on how you're paid to do things. I've been in a very capitated environment, and you're stopping people from going to the hospital, and instead of becoming a colleague, I became a cost, right? in the ED. So those things change. So I think all you need to do is make sure that we have a way to look at the population you serve, what the problems are there, and then what the system should do and how it does everything else. I think we need to leave open-ended for the change and innovation as things go down the road.
I realize we're still up against the time clock here a little bit, so I want to keep things moving along. I did want to bring up, just because I know it's came up in a couple of groups, especially about this medical care domain. We've heard a little bit about the time stamps and, door to doctor and 911 to arrival and all this kind of stuff. And I just wanted to know if you guys had any discussion. I know a lot of areas in the country are kind of moving away from lights and sirens to every 911 call now, triaging it along with emergency medical dispatch. And I just would hate to see us set a vision or, a future out there where we're still responding lights and sirens to every little minor, thing, a stub toe. It's a great liability. It's a lot of risk. It puts the public at risk as well as our providers. Was there any discussion of that in the group about how we can kind of move away from the those timestamps?
I think our group addressed that in a way, because we were sort of thinking about how do you determine. We think it would be ideal if every call for help was addressed and provided with the services that were matched for what the need was. And that's done through a scripted interview between the dispatcher and the caller, whether it's a bystander or the patient, to determine the level of need and then responding in like fashion, whether that's with BLS only, maybe it's ALS or, and also then whether it's lights and siren or it's a cold response. So we sort of addressed that and said that we thought that there was opportunities, and there are examples out there where that's what's done every day.
Yeah, we certainly talked about that issue, and about the only response time standard, if you will, that's out there is that and you should get an ambulance on the scene in first responders there in 4 to 6 minutes, and ALS there in about 9 minutes, and a lot of places adhere to that, but it's based on cardiac arrest survival, and if the public has any knowledge of that, they go, all the ambulances are supposed to be there within 9 minutes, but most of what emergency ambulances run on in this country, 80% plus, I would say, is really non-critical emergent situations. And to perpetuate that metric, many, many systems still run lights and siren to everything. It's in their policy. This is what we do. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that that's dangerous and not the smartest thing in the world to do. And I think we clearly don't want to do anything that would perpetuate that. And rather, I think it would be good to start someone down the path of defining what is an appropriate response and when is it appropriate to respond hot or cold. And as Kathy's saying, many systems don't have the tiers that APCO is based on, that Clawson is based on. My own system, we have nothing but paramedic level ambulances, so it's kind of pointless to have a BLS response because we don't have one to send. And likewise, you'll find places that don't have anything but a BLS system as well. And I think it's a very important point that needs to be pushed forward if we get the opportunity.
Me? But in the absence of, so you're saying, I appreciate that we don't have evidence, and I'm very glad, Andy, that you brought this up, but in the absence of having evidence, what we do is we come up with consensus, and this room right now could tell you that probably running lights and sirens for every non-urgent call is a bad idea. So doesn't the metric then, I mean, doesn't this just get concretely boiled down to the metric of you must have guidelines in place that are consistent with the consensus opinion? And I'm sure that the National Association of EMS Physicians and the SEMSO and the other organizations that I'm too ignorant to know about could provide that if it was an important thing to provide that, and that at the county and the state level, or the local level, wherever the rule book is made, if it were a metric that you had on the book, something that was consensus bound, that would happen, right? So that's metric one, and can't metric two then be for the EMS system their compliance with their rules? You can know when they run lights and sirens above and beyond when they're supposed to, and you can know when they don't when they're supposed to. So a proportion of runs that are consistent with policy seem to me that those are two very low-hanging fruit. Well, the first one not so much. The second one, a relatively low-hanging fruit metric. Those data, I apologize, I'm way outside of my domain, so I don't know if that data, and I'm ready for the beating, but I don't know if that data exists when you ran lights, sirens, when you didn't. And I don't know if there's really consensus about what proportion of the time for each condition it should be.
Well, there's probably not evidence, but there's strong consensus. And those are simple mandatory data elements of the existing national EMS information system, so it is there. But I think we've got to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the washwater. Using red lights does not necessarily equate to trying to drive real fast. Probably the most useful time you can use red lights on an ambulance is when you're going 12 miles an hour in a snowstorm, so people see you and they'll hit you, for example. So I think we have to carefully tailor. But the whether you have my systems like Tommy's, we have all paramedic ambulances, but we still use the Clausen classification system, because not only does it separate ALS from BLS, but it separates resuscitative, urgent, and emergent things and others pretty well. So it's out there. It's a matter of, again, providing incentives for that to be used, which don't exist. And this is another place where we got to reach outside of healthcare, because I'll bet in half the landmass of the United States, the 911 and emergency radio communication system is fully controlled by someone who is not in any way, shape, or form part of the healthcare system. That's the county sheriff who owns that and who decides whether the dispatchers will provide EMD or not. So if there was a buck attached to it someplace, you'd at least have a conversation.
I just wanted to address the data side of that question. And when it comes time to actually documenting these, I think we need to be very explicit in what exactly we think we mean when we say, I'm not saying that we would use response time, but using that as the old example, there are five different starting timestamps for response time and another five ending timestamps. So we need to be able to, so there's no standardization. So to just say response time is not well defined. So when we get to identifying things, we need to be very specific down to naming the field in the database that is used or the function that it serves. Otherwise, there won't be any standardization.
I'm going to support the fact that there needs to be a standardized way, definition, in a standardized way, so that when you're measuring systems and comparing them, maybe two neighboring systems, that there's parity in the way things are being compared, so that it's, you know, they're measuring it differently so they look better than me. I'm just pointing at the generic area over there, not any one individual.
I think we also need to be mindful of the fact that some of these decisions and discussions about EMS at the local level get made in a political and patient-sensitive or a patient satisfaction-oriented environment. and you know, having once been forcibly dragged out of an ambulance because I responded without my license siren to what the bystanders perceived to be something really emergent, like a, I don't know, a gunshot wound to the finger. You know, evidence is fine, safety is fine, but again, these people who are not part of our world get to have a vote in some of this, and we have to be mindful of the impact of that.
All right, we'd like to move on to group three, and I think Tommy has the great fortune to report out to the group, so I will turn it over to him.
Well, we had a robust discussion, and we have a lot of agreement with what I've already heard here from the other two groups. What we didn't have is consensus on who was going to report, so I'd like to call on the other members of the group to fill in the gaps since I'm working off of two sets of notes here. With regard to the general questions, we do believe that the six domains that have been identified are just fine. We don't think any are missing. We didn't really find any overlap among those domains. We did recommend making a change to the name of the third domain. In the second bullet, we think you should put a period after the word care so that it would say include structural and process components of regionalized emergency medical care, period. With regard to the specific questions, we believe that the emergency episode of care begins at the point in time that anyone recognizes that a potential need for emergency care exists. So not just the patient, but you know the bystander who walks by and sees the guy laying on the side of the road. And we recognize that it's hard to capture the data on that, but oftentimes it's available, especially with the advent of cell phones where 911 is concerned. A lot of times there's a bystander there, and in the course of asking the questions, you say, you know, when did this first happen, or when, you know, and so we believe that the attempt ought to be made. What system components are necessary to coordinate care across the settings? I guess I should slow down in case there's any. Okay. Rick provided us with some nice, neat packages, data, communications, clinical pathways and protocols, handoffs, which we call interfaces, and feedback mechanisms. Some of the specifics that we talked about was the availability of an electronic health care record throughout the continuum of care so that there's data sharing and data integration, and everybody within the system is able to get outcome data, understand where the patient went, what happened to them, that sort of thing. We talked a good bit as well about shared governance and accountability, how patients are being routed within a system. In my own system, I'm accountable to no one outside of my organization for what I do for the most part, other than license my people. And it's just not appropriate. I mean, there has to be some governing entity that controls the whole system if we're going to get good data sharing, if we're going to get people working on the same path. And it's done at a local level in a lot of places, but as we think about a regional system, that we really have to think about a governing authority of some sort. What system-level measures are important to assessing the coordination of appropriate care across the geographic and populations? Packages, again, cost, morbidity, mortality, unscheduled returns, unscheduled admits, readmits, rather, absence or presence of the structured protocol to guide the system, goes back to governance. Are there patient-centered, efficient, time-sensitive, and appropriately cost-efficient matrices that are based on acuity. And this got into the discussion that we just had about lights and sirens or everything, but basically level of acuity should have something to do with what
just how fast you're moving, not only in the pre-hospital setting, but otherwise. And then what outcomes are important to EMS systems. Let me look on the other page over here and make sure I didn't miss anything. Final outcomes, communicated to all the units of service, transfers to the emergency department, transfers to higher levels of care with and without admissions, readmits both to the ER, to the hospital, within some period of time to be defined by somebody besides us, unscheduled returns, time to mortality in some number of days, being able to capture patients that return somewhere else. And I think it's a moving target, but, somebody comes into your system, goes out, and shows up somewhere else in a short period of time. The system needs to be able to identify that as a fallout. I think that's what I have.
Yeah, I think the buckets, or the subdomains, the data, the communications, the clinical pathways, protocols, the handoff and transfers, we had a lot of great kind of neat discussion of what exactly those meant and, even data like you just alluded to. Do we know that this patient has been at 3 of the 4 hospitals in the region over the last week? Is there some kind of a public health surveillance component here that, hey, all of a sudden X, Y, and Z is becoming a real problem in our region? Maybe, there's something going on. Communications, we talked a lot about, online and offline medical direction for EMS providers, and where is that headed, and, where has it been, and where is it heading? Is there a single point of contact for the ambulance? Can I call from the ambulance and say, here I come with this patient, and get a response on what hospital's open, which one can accommodate me, where I should go? Clinical pathways and protocols, a lot about, do they exist? Do we have them? Are they standardized throughout the region, or at least very similar? Is there some kind of a standard EMS drug box, which amazes me that, depending on what county I'm in, I have to lock up certain drugs and get out other drugs. And then also in the handoff and the transfer section, not only handing off between pre-hospital to, the emergency department, but then that whole piece of, inter-hospital transport, and then also a piece that's, usually overlooked, the 911 call to the EMS, the handoff. So is there data there that's being captured? And it goes back to a lot of what, you guys were saying in your group. And then the unscheduled returns, including, repeat use of 911, repeat use of emergency medical services, all that kind of stuff. But I think Rick or anybody
yeah,
else?
Yeah, I think you've got most of it. I was going to say the issue of governance. And I don't know if you mentioned it, but we looked at it. We started looking at communication and feedback to the system and realize that's a big problem in terms of capability is just the loss of the patients, no feedback. So we talked about making it a learning system and use that as an overarching concept of being a learning system. So you're constantly giving feedback between the various players within the system so that you're always constantly growing. And then the other issue I was going to say, we looked at it at interfaces and having a structured way for interfaces to occur. And that is going into the hospital, but within the hospital, and then within hospitals, right? So we see those as places where and you can frame these things in terms of patient safety and effectiveness and efficiency, all these things. The other thing I'd throw up is just one, in terms of the last part, Tom, I think we talked about costs or finances as being there in terms of outcome measures. I don't know if we mentioned that or not. Did you? Okay. No, that's fine. Nothing. And then the other thing I would throw up is that, three and four are really ones that you could do a matrix that had at least input, throughput, output, going back to the thing, Tom's point or Art's point, and then compare that against the IOM attributes, right? So you could have those things and input, throughput, output, and transition. That may be a starting point for a matrix.
And I guess one more thing is we think about care coordination and this particularly the governance part, looking at the training, the certifications in that region, the people all have the same level.
Well, we didn't put workforce. We should have.
Right. And looking at even equipment, how many times do you go to a hospital and I got to start this kind of IV because they carry this brand and this kind of IV because they carry that brand and some are needleless and some aren't and all this kind of stuff. So, that's a very important part of the governance structure as well. Comments from the group?
Yeah, I just want a quick clarification. I apologize. Could you guys repeat your title change and where that specifically was?
I think it's under interface. Was it five? What's the one with the second?
Domain number three. Of the new domains.
It was the second paragraph in one of the domains, and we just thought the you could stop it earlier.
Yeah.
Keep going. Right there. You see it says include structural and process components of regionalized emergency care, period, is what the suggestion was, because it may be limiting.
Yeah.
I just want to bring up a comment from our group that that didn't carry forward, but I thought this group might just want to consider. Under medical care, there's three subdomains. So if one of the domains was out of hospital care, logically the other domain would be in hospital care, and then under each of those would be additional branch points or subdomains. But just from a logical point of view, that was a comment I made.
I'm going to get that in with you.
Any other comments about the domains or the work we've done in the groups today? Pretty exhaustive list, huh? All right. Well, at this point, we're going to switch over then, and be assured we're going to put the timeline back up here in a few minutes, and I want to make sure that you all know that you will have additional opportunity for input and comment on all this stuff, and our great folks at UNC are going to put this all into a nice document that we'll be able to see and look at and examine together. So I guess that kind of leads us into our next section here, which is the committee priorities for the second draft. So I'd kind of like to take just a little bit of time and maybe just go around the table just so we capture everybody's thoughts. As we've spoken about, UNC is going to be redrafting this framework based largely on everything that we've talked about in the last 2 days. So I guess I'll start with Jesse. Is there any kind of take-home message of the last 2 days' discussion? What is of utmost importance that you want to make sure is reflected in the document? I know it's hard to pick just one or two things, but is there any direction or any charge that you specifically would like to give to the UNC folks?
Sure. This is something that I've said before, but just make sure that we consider symptoms versus diagnosis and that is factored in, and also just adding into especially a lot of the definitions and wording wherever we say life threatening, to say potentially life threatening, which I think would encompass a large group of patients, and also patients with certain symptoms would also benefit from regionalization even if they don't have the true life threatening disease.
I think we're woefully short on data, which is amazing at this point in time, and I think we need to provide the infrastructure and the mandate, the data be collected on whatever topic you want to name, and use that data, make it transparent, and utilize that data in an overarching shared authority, shared accountability ruling model, so that we have somebody who we know is in charge, give them the mandate, share it with the caregivers to develop a combination accountability to move the process forward.
I would just say the work here is very good. The episodes of care and the domains and everything really mesh well. I would say that the measures are out there. They're commonly in use. They may not have peer review substantiation, which I know you seek, but, response times are long, that's usually bad, and if response times are short, that's usually good. I think some of those things are never going to be tested out. So I make a plea that we consider using some of those things that we know are valid, but that may not have met scrutiny at the level of peer review publication. And I would also echo what others have said, that you know, we were asked to come here to talk about measures, and what we've spent a lot of time talking about is how to construct a system that can measure itself.
I think that, as Ron has said, that data is really at the core of what we're all doing here. And as John has said, without a congruent system to collect that data, trying to develop quality measures is extremely difficult. I think that there are two things that a document like this could do. That could really help us move in those directions. The first is to make a strong case that emergency care is a public good and therefore requires a level of system oversight that that the rest of the healthcare system doesn't necessarily enjoy. And second, as the nation's healthcare information systems continue to be refined, that our hospital discharge data abstracts that explicitly address emergency conditions include at least an initial set of vital signs so we can get some sense of the physiologic derangement that results from the time sensitivity of these conditions. And that would go a huge long way toward helping develop at least a rudimentary set of measures that could help us achieve our collective goals.
I agree with my colleagues to my right, and I probably agree with my colleagues to my left.
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. You know, a lot of us around this table, it's funny, we've been dealing with systems issues for years, and yet healthcare still hasn't figured it out. And, you know, Walmart can track a pallet of sand around the world within 15 seconds. We lose them in the waiting room. There's an issue there. But, you know, with the changes going down the road, the financial survival of a lot of these healthcare hospitals and stuff will be dependent on our ability to work with others, I think. So this is a great opportunity to kind of create a bit of a model. So I'm very impressed with what I've heard. But I do think we need to make sure that we just don't have a document with a bunch of metrics, but there's a model there that people can see. But I think in the end, they have to see it as flexible and adaptive because, you know, my experience in California with they kept changing the way they paid every, like, 22 months is that you kept trying to change. And the problem with something, if it's too restrictive, is you block innovation and change, and so people don't adopt it. So I think, you know, a lot of the measures and things like that here will change over time and how you address things. But I think we just want to make sure we're flexible and it drives patient-focused outcomes. That'll be the best of all worlds, in my view.
I just want to reiterate what a great process this has been and what a great product so far has come out of this. I think I would encourage, as we look at pre-hospital care and out-of-hospital care, that we require that practice is evidence-based just as we're requiring it in the rest of healthcare, which has been very late to the table for pre-hospital care. And that as we look to processes, we don't overcomplicate the issues and focus on blocking and tackling, and look at simple evidence-based metrics.
Good point.
A couple of people have commented on data. I would like to add one piece to that data. I mean, often when we talk about data, we talk about outcomes data. And I think that we, in our group, it became very, very clear that it's very hard to come up with processes of care that are not dependent upon structures. So I think we need some fundamental structure data of what the system looks like so that we can appropriately come up with tiered processes. Because otherwise, I think we know what they will be. They will be the lowest common denominator processes, and we will all be unhappy with them. So that's sort of my first point. And my second point is that I strongly, strongly believe that we need to incentivize co-opetition. If we're not the running, the patient being the baton and us running in a relay is a great analogy, except right now each of us gets a different color medal at the end of the relay race instead of us all either getting the gold or not. So if we don't force ourselves to compete and cooperate at the same time, I think we miss an opportunity here.
Of course, I agree with Ron and a lot of the others around the room that talk about the it just flabbergasts me that we are trying to build systems and perform care without really knowing what the numbers are. And so the data dearth is just astounding. I would encourage us to get information about the populations that we seek to serve. That's why we're here. And so I think population measures, while hard to get, are things we need to seek so that we build systems that meet their needs. And then, you know, along the lines of as we provide care, having each step, whether it's phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, having quality measures within each one of those and have them feedback and inform not only the populations that we serve so they know what they're getting, but it also informs the system to go forward and improve.
I also agree with most of the comments that have been made. The issue, I'm concerned about the issue of data standards, and that's a process that could take many years to work through. There's a lot of activities that are already going on data standards and have been going on. And if we wait to start building the measures till after those standards have been put into place, that could take a long time. So it would be nice to start with some of the low-hanging fruit, some things that we can do without having that deep of a requirement. And one that popped into my mind is something that's fairly simple process-wise, but many EMS providers can tell you which hospitals will share patient information with them and which ones won't. If you deliver a STEMI patient to a hospital, you may or may not learn if it was a patient that ended up going to the cath lab. Did they triage them out with the EKG in the ER? Did they refer them for follow-up? Something as common and as simple as that, there's no feedback loop. And that's something that could be addressed without technology. Otherwise, the only other thing I wanted to mention is it'd be nice if we could mention some of the current examples of best practices that are being used in various places. There are some people using technology now to share information or to do different things, and they probably would appreciate getting that kind of attention because they have invested the time, energy, and money into doing that. So recognition for them, or using that as a learning point. What can we learn from what they have done?
Well, first of all, let me just say I've learned a great deal at this meeting, and I appreciate being here. I would like to say that one of the things that I consider to be most important is determining how we will know what the outcomes are of this entire EMS system and what results we're actually getting. And that, I think, can be done with the better data collection at the hospital end. But that's one thing I'd like to see come out of this. I also think that the interface that was talked about is very important, the interface between all the providers at various levels, because I've seen situations where there's been things that have been dropped because of the interface, and that's caused some serious problems down the road, not only between the EMS system and the hospital emergency room, but between the emergency room and the providers in the hospital, and even between the providers in the hospital and the eventual destination of the patient after they leave the hospital. So I think that all those things are part of the system and need to be worked on and hopefully discussed in this publication. The other thing I'd like to say, which hasn't been talked about here very much, is that when this is written, the attempt should be made to make it consistent and congruent with the EMTALA laws, because there's a lot of things that we've been discussing here, various issues which are covered by the regulations, by the state guidelines, and by a number of things which, if not dealt with, will possibly cause problems down the road. And so I would hope that at least as this is being done, that there are some considerations given to that statute, which is an overriding feature in all this. Thank you.
I, too, really enjoyed participating in this process. Three comments. You know, EMS has been called the intersection of public safety and public health, and I don't think I've ever heard it put quite like Dr. Cooper did earlier, but emergency services is just different in a way, and it is much more of public interest than other aspects of health care because you don't have a lot of choices when you're in a crisis situation, and I think this regulation piece that we've talked about so much is just extremely important. We keep talking about pre-hospital care and other emergency care, and, you know, we need to start thinking that about pre-hospital care as the pre-hospital component of emergency care. When we stop thinking about it as a different animal than the rest of healthcare, then we'll start seeing it studied and researched and funded like other special interest areas are, or, well, special interest may not be the right word. And finally, I think that the solutions are not going to all look alike. When regions develop very well-defined regionalized systems of care, they're going to be very different because of many factors, and we need to look at identifying centers of excellence that we can put forward as good examples that others can pick and choose pieces of that will work in their system and share their successes as well. Thank you.
I agree.
First of all, great session. Thank you. Thank you all for participating. Thank you for accepting an extraordinary percentage of the draft framework and for your really useful comments and hard work today. I think those concepts that you've discussed are important. I think the challenge is trying to put them into a framework that will be understood by those who do performance measurement, and that's what I look forward to working with our colleagues from NQF to do. And I think your comments on the need for leadership and structure and potential policy should be something we will continue a dialogue with our federal partners on. And thank you all again. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to be here, and look forward to your comments on the next draft.
All right. At this point, we open the public comment session for those in the room or those who are joining us by telephone. So anyone in the room would like to say a few words? Cynthia?
All good? All right. Thank you. So come out from behind the post here. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to have been able to observe such impressive conversation and expertise for the last day and a half. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm Cynthia Hansen, and I work at ASPR. I had a couple of comments that I wanted to put forth for the committee's consideration. Being at the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, the concept of surge is quite critical, and while it's essential that day-to-day operations be successful, and I know that's the necessary focus of this group's work, the idea of a regionalized surge capacity in the event of a catastrophic event is something I would put forward for your consideration as an additional element. Secondly, with all the robust conversations that happened, I'd also like to put forth to you, as you describe the domains, to be sure and include psychiatric behavioral health examples, and to balance out the med surge focus that I've that's an easier conversation sometimes to have, and also that healthcare in this country is also delivered through tribal health, either through 638 compacts or Indian Health Service. And I would hope that the intersection and linkages with those emergency medical services would also be considered as you look at measurements. I was really struck by, I think it was one of you guys who were talking about the link with non-healthcare entities such as sheriff's departments. and that those linkages are in some ways part of the challenge of a regionalized emergency care services. And I know this is a tremendous challenge. I would just bring forth these particular issues for the group's consideration. Thank you.
Build on the ASPR theme. Hi, my name is Greg Margolis, and I work for the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And I'd like to also take an opportunity to thank each and every one of you for participating. As you probably know, this is a project jointly sponsored by ASPR and ASPE, the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. And based on where I work, I can at least extend my appreciation on behalf of Dr. Nicole Laurie, the ASPR, for your participation. It's been an interesting experience. I've known many of you for a long time, and this is a little bit of a new role for me, being in the back of the in the peanut gallery, if you will, as opposed to around the table. But it's been a very rewarding experience, and I applaud the progress of the group. Obviously, ASPR's interest in this particular project really does focus on emergency preparedness, and it does recognize the fact that emergency preparedness is built on an efficient and effective emergency care system every day. And I am very encouraged at the amount of conversation that has gone on over the last 2 days that make sure that we measure and report and come up with metrics to look at variables such as emergency preparedness, ED crowding, boarding, and diversion, which Dr. Laurie views as true preparedness issues. The other thing that I'm impressed as the group has gone around, I'd like to tell you how important of work this will be. Skip had a question early in the dialogue of how's this going to be used. I think it's going to be used in a lot of different ways. In particular, there has been a fair amount of conversation about, well, who's in charge and how do we make everybody responsible, and we can have, there's a variety of policy levers that exist, and certainly centralization and authority and responsibility from a top-down perspective is one way that we can look at the emergency care system and may work in certain cases, but doing that in a private sector healthcare system is very challenging when the majority of the system works in a very different way. So in particular, I see this project as really starting us down the path of public reporting, and I would hope that you all realize the incredible power in a private sector world that public reporting can have. And we are really starting to talk about, for the first time, a way that we can, on a website such as Hospital Compare or whatever, we can actually allow elected officials, policymakers, and other people that have responsibility for various sectors of the population to be able to evaluate the quality of their emergency care system and to compare it to other systems and of similar challenges, and hopefully then to make resource allocations and communities decisions about what they're willing to accept and how they want to start to fix some of their challenges. So there's incredible power in the work that is being done here, and it really has a tremendous opportunity to improve emergency care in this country. And then finally, it also has the opportunity, maybe for the first time, for us to start looking at aligning incentives to start encouraging the type of behavior that we want this private sector healthcare system to deliver. So again, I thank you all for your participation, and I will turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. I just want to thank you all for the opportunity allowing me to sit here in the peanut gallery and listening to great comments. As I was taking notes, trying to figure out what I would say, you've already said it all. So I concur with a lot, few disagreements, but it's going to come out, and I really look forward to looking at the second draft and seeing, because right now there's so many notes, I don't know what's, you know, I'm versioned out. So, but in the Office of Health Affairs in Homeland Security, we work with EMS, public health, and disaster preparedness kind of in that triangle. So I'm going to approach my viewpoints from that standpoint. But if there's anything we can do in our office to help or any questions, please feel free to call us, and I'll be working with Greg and the other colleagues here to help us make this the best document we can.
Operator, this is Andy Rozak. Is there anyone on the phone that would like to comment?
If you'd like to comment over the phone, please press star 1. Sir, your line is open.
Yes, this is Ken Nipper.
Hey,
can they hear me?
How you doing?
Can they hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ken.
This is Ken Nipper, National Volunteer Fire Council. I've caught most of it the last 2 days and find it very, very interesting. I would have to comment on the fact that somebody made a comment, a number of times a comment's been made, that to how important the cooperation of the fire chiefs and EMS chiefs will be. And as the chair of the National Volunteer Fire Council EMSR section, I would be interested in getting the copies of the draft and being kept in the loop on this.
Thank you, and you can go to the NQF website, which will have the timeline of when the next draft will be posted for public comment, and we certainly would welcome your comments on that draft, and we do take a look at them, and the steering committee considers all of those. So it's going to be posted for public comment as of now sometime in July, but the website will keep everyone updated if there are any changes. So that's the National Quality Forum's website. You can just put in NQF and Google it, and you'll find it pretty quickly.
Yes, I have already been on it.
So. Oh, fantastic. So we'll great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Operator, do we have any more comments?
Not at this time.
Okay, then we will close the public comment period, and we will move to the last portion of the agenda for today, which is the summary and next steps. And I will turn the mic over to Sally here.
So I'd like to say I agree with all the thanks to all of you for taking time to participate. I think your contribution has certainly enriched the draft that we have. We've got a lot of ideas about what to change now and how to continue to drive the system to be improved. I'd like to thank my team at NQF as well, Eric and Lauren, for keeping us on target and preparing for this meeting. That said, to go over some of the next steps, and Eric, feel free to jump in if I forget any. We'll be synthesizing the meeting notes. We will send those out for you all to review. Those are eventually posted for the public, as well as transcripts, which have been being taken, and a recording if you wanted to listen to 2 days of conversation. Again, we would certainly make that available to you. The meeting summaries and working with Chuck and Jeff at UNC and their team, and also thanks to you all very much for all the hard work that you've done so far, we will revise the draft. And it's a quick turnaround, so we'll be, if we have specific questions, we may contact a few of you based on some of the concepts that have been tossed around so that we can more quickly get that draft updated. But we will then send the draft back out to all of you in June. We will convene on the telephone, a steering committee conference call, after you've had a chance to review the draft, get your any final inputs, make sure that you all agree that it's ready to go out for public comment for a posting, and then we provide 30 days for that public and member comment. After we get that comments back, we put them into an Excel spreadsheet and we provide them to all of you so that you can take a look and make any suggestions if we need to adjust the framework at all. In the end, what we'll be looking for all of you is a recommendation that this framework move forward as an endorsed framework for this particular area, which means it goes to the CSAC, which is an oversight committee. They oversee all the steering committee work. And then if they agree with the recommendation, then it goes to the board of directors. So those are some of the details. But stay tuned for meeting minutes, summary, not minutes. The minutes will be the transcripts. But so making sure that we've captured key concepts. We'll be working directly with our UNC colleagues to keep this framework moving along. And then stay tuned for a draft in about three weeks, I'm thinking, or actually, yeah, about 3 weeks. Any questions about that?
All of the dates there are ballpark. So there's the little thing next to August 10th. I forget that word for it, but these are estimates of the dates. It should be around that time. I will send out, similar to what I did for the orientation call, a little link, and we will pick a day and a time around there that works for the majority of the committee members. Right, the June date is for the final, is for the webinar, and then we'll have another one in August. Yes. Yes.
Right. Yes. So that means two more webinars from the steering committee at least, one to look at the second draft, and then one to give us any guidance in reaction to our solicited public and member comment.
I'm just trying to make sure I am available or near the computer.
Absolutely. This week you can expect an email where we'll nail these down or solicit your input on availability, and we'll get those nailed down in stone really quickly.
All right. Well, I greatly appreciate, again, your attendance, your effort, your contributions. It was a great pleasure working with you, and thank you again. I hope you all have safe travels, and we'll be talking soon. And I officially adjourn this meeting.